Hi, my name's Tim Oldman. I'm the founder and CEO of the Leisman Index, the world's largest benchmarking and insight database on employee workplace experience. Since launching back in 2010, I've been fortunate enough to probe and debate the subject with some of the sector's best thought leaders, and these podcasts aim to package up some of those debates for you.
One of those awesome brains is here with me this afternoon in Stockholm. Jenica, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Jenica Lenning. I've been fortunate enough to be able to follow the development of activity-based working and when it actually stepped into the Scandinavian market around 2011, and been taking part of that journey ever since.
And that's what we're going to try and explore today, is some of the issues and concerns and problems that are around the brand of activity-based working. So it's an international thing. It's not a new thing. I think there is a perception that it's a new thing in certain markets, but it has a history.
It definitely has. I mean, it's not a new thing. I think the earliest projects that we can look back on has been there for over 20 years, if we look into the concept, and then there are developments and versions. But if we then look at the Scandinavian market, I say that was something that we started around 2011 or something like that.
Is there a difference then between a Scandinavian version of activity-based working and, let's say, the Australian or the origins in the Netherlands? Is it like an ingredient mix that is imposed differently in each place? Are there cultural differences? Is it that the organizations are different that they're imposed on? What makes it different? Or should we first try and understand what it is that we're talking about? What the hell is activity-based working?
Yeah, fascinating how similar it actually is if we look into the concept as we would define it and how we're working with it. But I was just reflecting with this, because, of course, there has been the evolution from the, if we just look into the physical work stream from the open landscapes, and then we had an era, at least in Scandinavia, with the flex office in the late 90s, with all the tech companies evolving and the dot-com era. You got your little hooch, how do you say that in English? Your little box with wheels that you were supposed to put your stuff and roll around in the office and find a desk to sit on. I think that some people would consider that to have been activity-based working. I would not, but I guess that was kind of the start of the physical work stream. That for me would still be just a flex office. That is something totally different.
Okay, so this is hopefully why some people are going to be listening to this, is to understand what activity-based working is. And we've jumped straight on in, and we're already starting to have a debate of whether it works or not, whether the history is rightly applied to it. Just let's define it. 3-minute elevator pitch on what is activity-based working.
Activity-based working is a catalyst for organizations to rethink the way they work, aligned to the cultural and strategic objectives. So, I mean, it really starts with business visions and goals and what you want to become and how you think you need to work in order to be successful in achieving that. And then you have to create a way of working, taking you into that direction, and then create a physical and virtual work environment to support that way of working.
I mean, let's just be honest, you had to read that first statement, right? Because activity-based working is complicated, and you've had to hone something that you think is a better definition. Is that partly because there's so much misunderstanding? So you as an organization have had to be really careful and craft a statement that says what it is, because there are so many people who are, I don't know, whether they're miscommunicating, whether they've misunderstood it, whether they're diving on in and buying something that is almost like a fashion trend at the moment or a fad, without really comprehending that we're talking about a business strategy, not a design strategy, right?
Yeah, but the physical part is so easy to see. You have all these study tours around activity-based working, and what you actually do in the study tour is that you visit another office and you walk around through the offices, and what you see is a lot of cool furniture, but you don't maybe really discuss why those different type of work settings are there and the reasoning behind it. And that is just 1/3 of what activity-based working is about. If you really want to understand the concept, you have to dig so much deeper into the way of working, and definitely also the virtual stream and what kind of virtual tools people are using to share knowledge and information, because that is actually the foundation and the core of it.
So the problem, part of the problem at least, is that you can't photograph a business strategy, right?
There are so many good architects out there, and they're really good at creating these fantastic environments that are visually attractive, and they make nice pictures and win awards of being beautifully designed. but I mean, that doesn't really say that it's a functional office really supporting the business. It can be. I mean, that would be the best combination, right? If you have this wonderful design where people really feel good about themselves and it's also really support the business. But I've seen some really good activity-based work environments as well with quite ugly furniture, to say so, because they didn't have that type of money, but it's really, really supporting what they do.
So just thinking about the infrastructure, the way an interior designer or architect then has to configure a space to support activity-based working, do they look different? Are they arranged differently? Do they have different components in different volume? Is it something that if I showed you two plans of buildings, you could say, yeah, that's an ABW environment, that one isn't? Is it that obvious to an outsider?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, an activity-based office, you will really find a large palette and a large variations of different types of work settings.
So you're developing the strategy that sits behind the organizational infrastructure, but architecture is important to this then. You can't deliver ABW without an element of activity-based design understanding, right?
I think there has to be a really great connections with the strategies, working out the way you're working and the architects.
So what we're saying is there's almost a clue in the title, because it's activity-based working. The center point for this as a strategy is understanding the activity that an employee is undertaking in a typical working day. And then the first component, perhaps, or one of several components, is to design a physical infrastructure that supports that collage of activities.
Yeah.
What else is there? You mentioned the virtual and the behavioral. So how about the virtual? What sort of virtual tools would an organization have to undertake to invest in properly in order to deliver the Venn diagram? We're only on two circles at the moment, on design and now into virtual. So what sort of tools?
Because you always end up in these dialogues. People are so afraid that someone is going to take their desk away. But if I would say, if you can choose whether I'm going to take your desk or your computer, I think that most people would be more stressed that they wouldn't have a computer. Just go to your office for a day and the network is not there. You feel completely handicapped. That is much more our work environment today than the physical work environment. So we need, of course, a digital workplace strategy that allow us to access all the information that we need, regardless of time, place, and device. And for many entrepreneurial companies, smaller companies, this is not an issue. I think there are so many companies and people out there who's been working for years having the office on their pocket. But for many large organizations, this is a real challenge. They're kind of locked into old systems, you have thousands of employees and the spectra of different types of devices that you have that can't really talk to each other and connect, and system that can't talk to each other and connect. And then you apply all the security levels on top of that where you can access from clouds and what you need to be actually locked into the office walls to be able to access.
So is that why a financial services organization might find it tougher? Does a clothing retailer or a furniture retailer, both of which I know you're working with at the moment on an activity-based working scheme, is it somehow going to be easier for them with less regulatory framework around technology to deliver a highly effective activity-based working environment?
I would say so. I mean, if you say the goal is that you're supposed to access all information regardless of place, then that will be easier for some companies than others. Because with the security regulations that you have within a financial company would probably not make it possible to access all the information from other places than the physical office.
So aside of the fact that you're an ABW strategy consultant and therefore everybody should be buying ABW, is there a type of client or an activity or an organization where you'd actually start to think this isn't the right route for you? Is it, or is it ABW for all? Is ABW the panacea to high performance organization?
If you define activity-based working as something that is there to actually support the activities that everyone does, I would say that activity-based working is for everyone.
Yeah, so you put it that way. It's why wouldn't you do it? But
but that also means that, of course, from a very analytical company, you have hundreds of analysts coming into work every day, and their main task is actually to sit in front of the computers hours in a row, or a programmer, program developer for that instance. Of course, that physical work environment would look completely different from a sales office or you know, with people who are hardly there. They're out often meeting with clients and so on. And the way these people would use the physical work environment is also very, very different. But they would still be able to work activity-based, but they need completely different types of work settings.
So activity-based working doesn't come in a box, right? It's not like a software as a service that you can deploy off the shelf as a sort of jigsaw puzzle with a picture on the front that you've just got to put the parts together. It's
definitely not. Definitely not. I've seen so many examples of people trying to implement activity-based working. So, okay, they take away some of the desk and then they go to IKEA and they buy some nice sofas and change the desks. And then they have this workshop about, you know, the rules of how we're going to start moving around, and that's it. And maybe an evening before where you have some pizza and beer and throw away papers, and that's the concept. And I wouldn't say that will be activity-based working.
So let's just bust a few myths. Is it a caveat of activity-based working that nobody gets a desk?
I would say so. I don't think that there is a reason that anyone should need a desk of their own. But I can really see that there are people within organization who has roles, meaning that they need to use fully ergonomic desk and even maybe in an enclosed room for several hours during a working day. And then that type of work setting should definitely be there for that person to use whenever they need it.
Next one then. ABW is a space-saving strategy.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that. We've seen a lot of business cases, of course, that you can save space. And for some companies, that's a reality. It depends, of course, where you're starting from. If you're starting from where you have a lot of square meters per employee, working out the activity-based physical work environment, of course, you can find out that you can actually save square meters. I would say for most Scandinavian companies, that is not true, because so many companies has already gone through that journey. They've already squeezed so many people in, and we made the journey from, you know, people having desks of their own, like 180, and then they threw away those desks. They became 160, 140, and now we're down to 120. I've seen companies with desk 1 meter. So that's the journey. And then when you have a facility manager who thinks that activity-based working would be a way to squeeze in even more people already taken up that journey, they would, be quite surprised when we come back and tell you that I'm sorry that you actually have to even add maybe some more square meters because you've already eaten your cake.
Yeah, and you're squeezing juice from the pips, right?
Yeah, now.
So,
yeah.
Okay, so myth number three seems to be that simply by adding a few breakout spaces, a library, a foosball table and some beanbags, you've delivered activity-based working. What's the myth busting on the sort of the furniture aspect or the distribution of space aspect?
Yeah, but you really, really have to do your math. You can really calculate how many work settings you need and the variety and do your homework in that. So you really have to look into the different type of roles or personas you have in the company and their activity pattern, and also look into the personality aspects of when you do different type of activities, what you actually prefer as a person. I mean, you can, everyone as a parent can relate to discussions with your teenager trying to do homework with the, you know, loud music streaming in the room, but actually some people tend to be more effective when they actually are in a buzzy environment. And then we have other people when they need to do concentrated, focused work, they need a room of their own. So you have to take all that into account and actually also know how much of our time in this company do we spend or want to spend collaborating, whether working alone, working in pairs, what types of meeting do we have, how many people attend these meetings, to really, really make a great activity analysis as a baseline.
Okay, so you've worked with the client, you've delivered a successful activity-based working infrastructure on all of those three pillars. What does a typical working day look like for me as an employee walking into that new environment?
For me as an employee, I will have the empowerment and the flow in my day of working. I mean, it all starts with me and my own capabilities of self-organizing my working day and the activities that I really need to do. And of course, I mean, first I have need to do my homework and really make sure that the activities that I do are connected to the team goals, the organizational goals. So yeah, you have that connection to what we're actually going to do as a company and what is my role in that. And then you actually split it into activities. So when I wake up in the morning, I look in my phone and I look at my task list and I know that, you know, the most important thing I need to deliver today is this report. And I have it actually on top of my list. So then I can actually decide already in the morning and or have an idea of where do I actually need to physically place myself today to achieve the best results in creating that task.
So this worries me a little bit though, because this implies then that perhaps the reason that some of the activity-based working schemes that we've seen, especially here in Scandinavia, we're in danger of seeing in the UK and perhaps in Australia, are that the failure is somehow in a lack of trust in the employee to self-determine, and that maybe that also comes down to a lack of leadership quality in accurately describing what it is that employee's role is within organizational goal frameworks. Is that,
absolutely.
Do you think?
No, absolutely. I mean, and now we're into the behavioral stream.
Yeah.
So that is all about having leaders who are extremely good at setting very clear goals and having this continuous dialogue with their employees. You don't have just this conversation once a year when you are discussing your salary. I mean, this is a continuous performance management process that you really need to be working on and have a clear understanding of what your role is and what you're supposed to deliver. And when we have managers who is very good at that, then they also have to let go and bring the freedom of choice to the employees to decide for themselves and have that trust in that relationship.
This is tough though, isn't it, right? Because what effectively you're saying is that managers, team leaders have to be very clear, have to communicate well, they have to be strong leaders, but that part of the success is also that employee, that team, that group can work in a distributed way wherever they like within an infrastructure. So somehow your management responsibility as a middle manager becomes more onerous in your communication.
Yeah.
But there's no line of sight. You can't see where those employees are. They could be loafing off in a sofa downstairs somewhere in a nice cozy corner. And
yeah, isn't that scary? You're not in control anymore.
So the trust is
as a manager.
The trust is massively important then. So how do you bed in that trust from a strategic perspective, where before maybe it hasn't been? Because if you have line of sight, if you can see your team in front of you, if you've got the corner office or the big desk, the 1.8-meter desk, and your team are sat outside just beyond you at 1.2-meter desks. Yeah. Suddenly you as a consultant are coming in and saying, hey, guess what? You're not going to be able to see where those people are, but you need to be even clearer with them in determining what their outputs are.
But I'm also fascinated that actually managers truly believe that they're in more control because they physically can see their employees.
But this goes back to the history of workplace.
Do they actually know what they're doing behind their computer? They couldn't, you know, be playing Candy Crush for looking at Facebook for whatever I know. I mean, that's going to do the work.
So we're then leaning towards more outcome-based measurement of employees, right? It's about them achieving what they're there to do.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then, I mean, you said communication, continuous communication, that will be the key, but then also using the new tools that we actually have with our virtual collaboration tools. And of course, that is a different way to manage for many people. And really have a dialogue on how to use all these new tools. I think that is actually what's happening now. There's so many new devices and applications that pop up within an organization, but I rarely see that companies has a structured dialogue on how to use which channels and tools. So, I mean, Tim, how do you prefer to be connected? By email, or should I actually call you, or send a text, or a chat, or what's your, if we would have a manager or employee relation, what will be our preferred way of having these, continuous?
And is that something then that an organization can allow managers and employees to dictate themselves, to determine, self-determine their preferences in communication style, or is it something where, from the virtual perspective, a framework needs to be in place that says this is the way we communicate? To what level of flexibility is there around that?
I think both. Of course, you need a framework. I've been working with companies who, where they found out that, half of the employees were communicating via an application that was actually forbidden to use within the company. So the ones who were really following the regulation, they never knew whether their friends were going to have lunch. So of course, you actually need to decide upon and maybe be very strict, saying that these are the framework of the channels that we are going to use. But then you need to have a dialogue within the team. What type of communication do we use different types of channels for?
Okay, so on the assumption that the physical infrastructure has been well considered and sized and designed, and that the virtual environment, the technology and services environment has been well considered and structured, we're really only scratching the surface on the behavioral, right? That the idea that you could somehow parachute drop employees into a brand new environment on a Monday morning with a chairman cutting the red ribbon and with a champagne flowing and a ta-da moment as the new space is operational. That's surely a disaster waiting to happen. So how do you coach and train and prepare employees for this? What for some of them is going to be a dramatic change in direction for a style of working.
There's so much preparation that needs to be done.
But how far back do we need to go in this preparation?
It can be years. I mean, I've been in so many situations where we kind of present this little box where you're supposed to, in the future, put all your material, a little box of 40 times 40 times 40 centimeter. And then you look what it looked like today, and you have all these tons of files. Some companies just go, well, you just work
go
it
figure.
Out.
Yeah,
go figure. You have 2 years. This is what you're going to get in the new building. And this is what you have today. So, just start throwing away.
There's the future.
The future. Knock yourself out. But to some extent, of course, I wouldn't say that you need these evenings where you have beers and eat pizza and actually just throw away stuff, because of course there is so much junk in offices. But when you've done that and you still have a lot of documentation left, it can actually be that you have a very physical process of doing things. And then we're really looking into the core of the business, that this is a business process that we have that needs to be digitalized. And usually most ABV project teams, they don't have the power to deep dive into that process, but that support needs to be there to actually change that process. We have one example from a company who digitalized all their accounting process. And that was an initiative of their own. But there is no one than that department with that manager in lead of it who can be in charge of of doing such a thing that can never be done from the ABV projects. So depending on what type of business you are, that can be an enormous journey, and you really have to look into it. Because so of course they're gonna struggle and cry when someone tells them that they're just gonna get this small locker in the future and no help. They're still stuck in a process that maybe they don't have the authority themselves on a personal level to change.
And is that because organizations sometimes are shy to explain the processes that they're going through, that somehow the, you know, in that organization, it may well be that the head of infrastructure services is working on a colossal project, but because it's a project that is work in progress, the lack of transparency to those projects promise to deliver a different infrastructure for the future makes it almost impossible. Can we expect that employee who's been promised the 40 by 40 by 40 locker with a digital thing on the front, a padlock on the front, to trust that their organization is exploring and expanding and developing the virtual and behavioral infrastructure that will allow them to work in that way? Is that part of the problem? But I'm going to answer my own question a little bit, because I wonder whether in Sweden, where there is a different cultural trust, I think, between employer and employee here that we don't see so much in the UK, and maybe in other territories in Europe, in France and Germany, where workers' councils are more prominent. Is it easier to develop that contract between employer and employee here of trust and empowerment, perhaps?
I think we have that in many organizations already today, that trust between the manager and the employee, and a very high level of self-leadership and ability to decide for yourself how, when, and where you work. So I think that is really not the issue. I would say that what we're struggling the mostly with in Scandinavia is more on a structural level.
What do you mean by structural level?
It's all these processes, the document handling process, the implementation of the digital workplace, and not just, you know, bringing the tools, but actually having an idea of how they're supposed to be used, to actually support the organization, not saying that this is your locker for the future and how you get there, that is kind of up to you. But most organizations, of course, they already have these initiatives ongoing when they decide to go activity-based working. So, but what is good if you're actually building a new house, there is all of a sudden a deadline. I mean, who actually prioritize to sort and throw away documents and, you know, rearrange your files on your computer? For most people, that is something that would come very low on your to-do list when you're busy.
Right, we're in Sweden. I need to ask you about fika. Explain fika to people, because I think fika is an imperative ingredient in successful ABW, and I think it might be why ABW isn't working so well in the UK or it's never going to work in America. Tell me about fika.
Fika includes coffee or tea, but mostly good coffee, and even something to go with it, especially a cinnamon bun, preferably, would be the most traditional fika. But this can take place at work, but it can also be discussions around it. Includes the socializing as well. That can be both personal, private, but most of the times as well also used to discuss business.
So I think this is something that we should be exploring in the future, as to whether the social infrastructure of space is a key ingredient in delivering a successful activity-based environment. That actually, it's not just about you and I bumping into each other in the corridor and let's solve that business problem that's been hanging around for ages. And rather, maybe in an activity-based working environment, we bump into each other in the corridor and say, "Do you fancy a coffee?
Yeah.
Do you fancy fika? Let's meet downstairs and gorge out on cinnamon buns." And suddenly, that problem is solved in a non-diarized, non-structured way.
More fika to the people will actually, you know, increase their innovation and in creativity in many organizations, I think. Instead of just having these planned meetings, you know, let's meet at 8 a.m. in this meeting room and we sit on these hard chairs and look at each other. But instead, you know, fika, that will do it.
Sounds like a revolutionary call. Fika for the people.
Fika for the people, absolutely.
Jenica, thank you very much for your time. It's been a real pleasure. I hope we've explored some areas that are going to intrigue people. help them on their journey, or maybe just help them decide whether they go down the road or not. That feels to me like a healthy outcome from this episode, that if at the very least they stop and pause for a moment and understand the complexity of the task they're about to undertake, and if they do or they don't go down the road, at least they make that decision in an informed way.
Totally agree. It's been a pleasure.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, look, I hope that's got you thinking. And if you have a suggestion for a subject you'd like me to probe or someone you think I should be talking to, please feel free to let me know. You can, of course, connect with me or anyone of the Leisman team via any of the usual channels. And to stay up to date with our thinking, just head to leismanindex.com. Thanks for listening.